On ABC Radio National, this is Big Ideas. Hello there, I'm Geraldine Doog, and I'm delighted to be with you today to introduce the Centre for Independent Studies' 26th annual John Bonython Lecture, which was delivered by Neil Ferguson. Neil's the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard University, the William Ziegler Professor at Harvard Business School, and a Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. A prolific commentator on contemporary politics and economics, he's a regular television, radio, and print commentator on both sides of the Atlantic. He's also the author of numerous books, including The Ascent of Money, Empire, The Rise and Demise of British World Order and the Lessons for Global Power, and Colossus, The Rise and Fall of the American Empire. Professor Ferguson is also a contributing editor of the Financial Times. He writes frequently for Newsweek, and he was noted by Time magazine in 2004 as one of the world's 100 most influential people. Now, today he'll argue that great powers or empires are, in the strict sense of the word, complex systems made up of very large numbers of interacting components that are quite asymmetrically organised. In other words, he continues, their construction more resembles a termite hill than an Egyptian pyramid, and they operate somewhere between order and disorder. From the Four Seasons Hotel in Sydney, Professor Neil Ferguson with Empires on the Edge of Chaos.
Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen,
this year, on the 200th anniversary of Lachlan Macquarie's appointment as Governor of New South Wales, I think it's appropriate that the Bonython Lecture should have an imperial theme. Now, you may have noticed during dinner some rather striking pictures on these screens. And if you were too enthralled in conversation, there's one on that little card on the table right in front of you. That picture is part of a cycle of extraordinary paintings, five in all, produced just around 10 years after Lachlan Macquarie's death in the United States by an artist named Thomas Cole. And these paintings fascinate me because they depict the life cycle of an empire. In fact, the five paintings are entitled collectively The Course of Empire. You can see them, incidentally, the next time you visit New York, if you go to the New York Historical Society, where they're housed. The one you've got on your table is actually the fourth in the cycle. The first is entitled The Savage State and just depicts a natural wilderness. It's always the same geographical location in each case. The second depicts farmers, Arcadia, and is entitled The Pastoral State. The third and much the largest canvas depicts a kind of classical emporium, a marble scene of splendor and prosperity, and is entitled The Consummation of Empire. What you're looking at is the destruction of empire. And the final scene in the five is entitled simply Desolation. The message is clear. All empires, no matter how magnificent they may be, are condemned to decline and to fall. Now that's, I think, essentially how we've all been raised to think of the historical process, as an essentially cyclical one. It's an approach which has a very long tradition in Western civilization, stretching back, in fact, more than 2,000 years. In the histories written by Polybius, the process that he calls anacyclosis proceeds in the following order. This is a political cycle. The first stage is monarchy, the second is kingship, then comes tyranny, then aristocracy, then oligarchy, then democracy, and finally something Polybius called ochlocracy, which is the rule of the mob, something we have, of course, in Australia today. Just joking. In Giambattista Vico's extraordinary Scienza Nuova, there's a ricorso, or recurrence process, of three historical phases in the cycle. You go from the divine to the heroic, which is the feudal monarchic, and you end in the human or democratic. It's another cyclical theory of history, though from much, much later. In the early 20th century, Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West offered a biological model where civilizations were organisms that had thousand-year life cycles and went through seasons, always ending in a miserable winter. Arnold Toynbee, nobody reads Arnold Toynbee anymore, but once he was a best-selling historian, it's a warning to us all, wrote a 12-volume study of history which posited another cycle, challenge, followed by the response of creative minorities, and then came inexorably decline, what Toynbee thought of as civilizational suicide, when leaders stopped responding creatively to the challenges that they faced. And you know, cyclical theories like those remain popular to this day. I doubt if many people in this room have read any of the authors I've mentioned so far, but quite a few of you have probably read my good friend Paul Kennedy's great bestseller, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, published back in 1987. That's another cyclical theory, a theory of imperial overstretch, as great powers overextend themselves through conquest and imperial overstretch, and that process causes their economies at home to suffer, to decline, and to bring the empire down with it. Most recently, Jared Diamond's book, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, offers a final cyclical theory of history. Environmental cycles, all the way from 17th century Easter Island to 21st century China, as societies rise and exploit their natural resources, overdo it, and then succumb to natural disasters of one sort or another. With all these different cyclical theories in our minds, in our subconscious, even if we haven't read those books, I'm always struck by how that idea is kind of there in the popular psyche. We naturally tend to assume that in our time, history will also move cyclically and slowly. Think of the environmental or the demographic threats that we all love to chatter about. They do seem very, very remote, don't they? Maybe that's why we don't mind talking about them. But in an election year, who really cares or talks about the average atmospheric temperature in the year 2050, or for that matter, the age structure of the population? The cycle will take care of this while we focus on burning issues like traffic congestion in Sydney. And yet it's possible, ladies and gentlemen, that this entire cyclical framework that I'm describing to you is in fact flawed. Maybe, just maybe, Cole's artistic representation of imperial birth, growth, and eventual death is a misrepresentation of the historical process itself. What if history isn't cyclical and slow-moving? What if it's arrhythmic? At times, it's almost stationary, but it's also capable of accelerating very suddenly, like a sports car. What, ladies and gentlemen, if collapse doesn't arrive over a number of centuries, but comes suddenly, like a thief in the night? I want to suggest to you tonight that great powers, empires, are, in the strict sense of the word, complex systems. They're made up of very large numbers of interacting components that are quite asymmetrically organized. In other words, their construction more resembles a termite hill than an Egyptian pyramid. They operate somewhere between order and disorder, on the edge of chaos, in the wonderful phrase of the computer scientist Christopher Langton. Now, complex systems, as they're properly understood, can appear to be operating stably. They can seem to be in equilibrium for quite some time. But in reality, they're constantly adapting, evolving, mutating. But there comes a moment when all complex systems go critical. A very, very small trigger can set off what the scientists call a phase transition from a benign equilibrium to a crisis. You all know the examples. The single grain of sand that causes the whole sand pile to collapse. Or the legendary butterfly in the Amazonian rainforest which flaps its wings and causes a hurricane in the home counties of England. To understand what I'm talking about, if you haven't read any complexity theory, just think of the things that scientists use the complexity theory to describe. Water molecules, as they form themselves unpredictably and yet symmetrically into snowflakes. Anthills, I already mentioned, termite nests, complex things, but not the products of a plan, the products of the almost arbitrary interaction of lots of tiny little insects. The canopy of a rainforest. All of these are authentically complex systems. Now, complex systems have certain things in common. One of them is that a quite small input to a complex system can have really huge and unanticipated changes. This is what scientists call the amplifier effect. When things go wrong in a complex system, the scale of disruption is in fact impossible to anticipate because there's no such thing as the typical or average forest fire. To use the jargon of modern physics, and here I do owe a debt to my scientific family, I'm the black sheep, but I always try to keep up. A forest before a fire is in a state of self-organizing criticality. It's teetering on the verge of a breakdown. But what you don't know is what size the breakdown will be. Will it be a huge and devastating conflagration or just a small, controllable fire? It's really hard to say. A forest fire twice as large as last year's is in fact roughly 4 or 6 or 8 times less likely to happen this year. That kind of pattern, which is known as a power law distribution, completely different from the normal distribution of the bell curve, is remarkably common in the natural world. It applies not just to forest fires, it applies also to earthquakes, and it applies to epidemics. You may possibly have been thinking as I was talking that it also seems to apply in the realm of finance. You never quite know how big the next crisis will be. And it turns out that financial crises don't follow the normal distribution. They follow a power law too. Well, what I want to suggest to you tonight is really quite interesting. I want to suggest to you that regardless of whether a great political entity is democratic or authoritarian, any large-scale political unit, like an empire or a great power, is a complex system in just that sense. And I could say exactly the same of financial systems. But tonight, let's focus first on empires. In other words, most big empires have a nominal central authority. Somebody is the hereditary emperor or king. But in practice, the power of the individual ruler is a function of that network of economic, social, and political relations over which the emperor presides. Very little control was exercised over Lachlan Macquarie by the men back in London. In fact, the British Empire was a perfect example of a self-organizing complex system in which constant adaptation occurred on the periphery as the individuals made their own decisions. It was a very, very large human version of the anthill. Now, because that analogy works well, it's not surprising to find that empires share many of the characteristics of the other complex adaptive systems I've been describing, including the tendency to move from apparent equilibrium, from apparent stability, to instability quite suddenly. That is the key fact that challenges the whole cyclical theory of history, which we, for some reason or other,
have grown so very fond of. Let me just give you a couple of examples. The Bourbon monarchy in France, in the 18th century, passed with amazing speed from triumph to terror. French intervention on the other side of the Atlantic, on the side of the colonial rebels against British rule, of whom we all, of course, deeply disapprove, seemed like a great idea to the French. It was a perfect opportunity to take revenge on Great Britain for its victory in the Seven Years' War. But that decision to intervene in the American War of Independence tipped the French monarchy over the edge into chaos. In May 1789, with the summoning of the Estates General, France's long-dormant representative assembly, a chain reaction was unleashed that led with amazing speed to the complete collapse of royal legitimacy in France. Just 4 years later, in January 1793, Louis XVI was decapitated by that extraordinary machine, the guillotine. Or take another case, more familiar in this room. Take the case of the collapse of the British Empire. We tend to think of that as a rather protracted process, and much history is written as if the British Empire began declining in the late 19th century. This is quite wrong. The zenith of the power of the British Empire in territorial terms was, in fact, in the 1930s. And to Winston Churchill, in 1945, sitting as an equal at Yalta with the other members of the Big Three, with Roosevelt and Stalin, it didn't seem as if the sun was going to set on the British Empire on his watch. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, within just a dozen years of Yalta, the United Kingdom had given up what became Bangladesh, Burma, I still call it Burma, Egypt, Eritrea, Ghana, India, Israel, Jordan, Malaya, Newfoundland, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and Sudan. All gone. The Suez Crisis in 1956 revealed the reality that the United Kingdom could no longer act in defiance of the United States in the Middle East, or pretty much anywhere else for that matter. The empire was, in effect, at an end. Now, if empires are, as I'm trying to persuade you, complex systems that sooner or later succumb to sudden and catastrophic malfunctions rather than, you know, cycling sedately from Arcadia to Apogee to Armageddon, what are the implications for the United States today? What are the implications of complexity theory for today's Anglophone empire? I think the most obvious point I'm going to make tonight, the one I want you to remember, so if your attention is wandering, which usually happens in most lectures at this time, do pay attention, is this. Imperial falls, forget all this decline. There isn't a decline, there's just a fall. Bang! Off a cliff. Are nearly always associated with fiscal crises, with dramatic imbalances between revenues and expenditures. And above all, here's the key idea. Anyone nodding off? Above all, these crises, these dramatic falls, are associated with the mounting cost of servicing a huge public debt. I'm going to give you four examples to illustrate my point. Let's start with Spain in the 17th century, actually even earlier, in the 16th. Already, as early as 1543, nearly two-thirds of the ordinary revenue of the Habsburg monarchy in Spain was going on interest payments on the juros, which were the loans that the Habsburg monarchy used to finance itself. By 1559, total interest payments on these things actually exceeded ordinary revenue. By this stage, the Spanish monarchy was essentially running on extraordinary financial expedience and the returns of its silver mines in Spain. 1584, 84% of ordinary revenue going on interest payments. 1598, back to 100%. When all of your ordinary tax revenues are going on interest payments, it is, ladies and gentlemen, game over. Think of France
in the 18th century. I told you that story about the French Revolution. But what you have to understand is why they called the Estates General. They called it because of a fiscal crisis. Here's the data. Here are the data. Between 1751 and 1788, in other words, the eve of the revolution, interest and amortization payments, debt service, rose from a quarter of tax revenue to 62%. Or take Ottoman Turkey, one of the great empires of the early modern period. By the 19th century, here's the story. Debt service rose from 17% of revenue in 1868 to 32% in 1871 to 50% in 1877, which was the time of the great Ottoman default, after which the Ottoman Empire in Europe, in the Balkans, essentially began to fall apart. And finally, let's revisit the case of post-war Britain. Already, by the mid-1920s, debt charges, interest and amortization, were absorbing 44% of total government expenditure. They already exceeded defense expenditure by a considerable margin. It wasn't actually until 1937 that the British government was spending more on defense than on interest payments, a very late stage indeed to embark on rearmament given the German and Japanese threat. Note also a really important kicker. When Britain's problems really got nasty after 1945, when the treacherous Americans cut off Lend-Lease and demanded the debts be honoured, a very substantial proportion of Britain's debt was held in foreign hands. Of the $21 billion of national debt at the end of the war, $3.4 billion were owed to foreign investors, to foreign creditors. And that was around a third of Britain's GDP in 1945. You'll see the significance of that in a moment. So, alarm bells, ladies and gentlemen, should be ringing very loudly indeed in Washington, D.C., as the United States contemplates a deficit for 2010 of more than $1.47 trillion. That's around 10% of U.S. GDP, and that's the second year running that the deficit has been that big. Since 2001, in the space of less than 10 years, the federal debt in public hands, that's excluding those parts of the debt held by federal government agencies in the United States, has doubled as a share of GDP from 32% to a projected 66% next year. And it just keeps going up. According to the Congressional Budget Office's latest projections, and this is using, if you're interested in this kind of thing, as I am, their alternative fiscal scenario, which they regard as the more politically likely of the two scenarios they produce, the U.S. federal debt could rise above 90% of GDP by 2020. It could reach 146% by 2030, 233% by 2040, 344% by 2050. And ladies and gentlemen, those figures do not include the vast unfunded liabilities of the Social Security and Medicare systems. Now, I rather imagine that to an Australian audience, in a country where the net debt is minuscule by the standards of the rest of the Anglosphere, these figures sound completely fantastic. But listen to me, there's more. Even more terrifying is to consider what this ongoing deficit finance could mean for the burden of interest payments as a share of US federal revenues. And this is where it gets really cool. The CBO projects that net interest payments could rise from where they are now, which is 9% of federal revenues, to 20% in 2020, 36% in 2030, 58% of federal revenues by 2040, and 85% of all federal revenues by 2050. My good friend Larry Kotlikoff recently pointed out in the Financial Times that by any meaningful measure, the fiscal position of the United States today is in fact worse than that of Greece. But Greece is not a global power. It hasn't been a major empire for a very long time, indeed. I think the real point, and the point of my lecture tonight, is that in historical perspective, unless something very drastic is done very soon, the US is heading into Habsburg Spain territory. It is heading into Bourbon France territory. It is heading into Ottoman Turkey territory. It is heading into post-war Britain territory. The fiscal numbers I've given you tonight are bad. There's no doubt about it. But in the realm of political entities and power, the role of perception is crucial. It may be more important than the actual numbers. Because in imperial crises, ladies and gentlemen, it's not the material underpinnings of power that really matter. It's expectations of future power in the eyes of those with the power, and even more so in the eyes of their enemies. Right now, I get the impression that the world, at least the Western world, basically expects the United States to muddle through and eventually to confront its problems, as Churchill famously said, to do the right thing when all the alternatives have been exhausted. And right now, with the sovereign debt crisis in Europe dominating the headlines, at least the headlines back home, and growing fears of a deflationary double-dip recession, bond yields are at historic lows, below 3% if you look at the 10-year US Treasury. So there's a pretty strong incentive there for congressmen to do nothing and to put off fiscal reform, to say, thinking of that cyclical theory of history, this is a problem for the next generation, not for us. You know, recently I was invited to a dinner in Washington to discuss radical fiscal reform for the United States. And I was quite excited, because I thought it would be like this. I wondered which huge hotel in Washington they'd booked and which ballroom we would be eating in. Three congressmen turned up. It's funny, except it's not funny. It's scary. There seems really, in fact, only to be one congressman who has seriously thought about how we could deal with this problem, and it's Paul Ryan. And I commend him to you as one of the few young Republicans who are prepared to talk seriously about stabilizing the fiscal position of the United States before it does go critical. The trouble is, for all those complacent congressmen of both parties who think this isn't an imminent problem, there's a zero-sum game at the heart of any budgetary process. Even if I'm wrong, and my old rival Paul Krugman is right, and that is possible, I don't rule that out. Even if he's right, and interest rates stay low, and the bond market is in a coma, and the vigilantes go off and take up some other activity, recurrent deficits, year after year, never much less than 5% of GDP, even on the administration's optimistic forecasts, plus debt accumulation as a result, mean, inevitably, that interest payments will consume a rising proportion of tax revenue. The process I've described to you is independent of any bond market panic. And as interest payments consume more and more tax revenue with every passing year, guess what gets squeezed? Not Social Security, not Medicare, the unreformable entitlements programs. The thing that gets squeezed is that discretionary item in the federal budget known as defense spending. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pre-programmed reality of US fiscal policy today that the resources available to the Department of Defense will be reduced significantly in the years to come. And I'm not talking about the 2050s, I'm talking about the next 5 years. Indeed, by my reckoning, at some point within the next decade, the US will reach the crossover point at which it will be spending more on debt service, on interest payments, than it is able to spend on defense. And remember, half the federal debt in public hands is in the hands of foreign creditors. And of that, a fifth, to be precise, 22%, is in the hands of the monetary authorities of the People's Republic of China. Down, incidentally, from 27% in July last year. Now, I suspect it hasn't escaped your notice that China now has the second largest economy in the world. And I expect you've also spotted that it is likely to be America's principal strategic rival in the 21st century, especially in the Asia-Pacific region. Quietly, discreetly, you haven't seen it in the headlines, the Chinese are reducing their exposure to US treasuries, I believe, as a result of a conscious policy decision to switch out of dollar-denominated claims on the US government and into nice, hard commodities, and preferably the mines that produce them. Maybe, just maybe, the Chinese have noticed what the rest of the world's investors pretend not to see, that the United States is on a completely unsustainable fiscal course with no apparent political means of self-correcting. Ladies and gentlemen, military retreat from the mountains of the Hindu Kush or the plains of Mesopotamia has long been a harbinger of imperial fall. It is no coincidence, after all, that the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan in the Annus Mirabilis of 1989, which was so closely followed by the complete collapse of the Russian Empire in Eastern Europe and in Central Asia. What happened just 20 years ago, like the events I have described to you tonight of the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, is a reminder that empires do not, in fact, appear, rise, reign, decline, and gently fall according to some recurrent and predictable life cycle. Rather, they behave like all complex adaptive systems. They function in apparent equilibrium for some unknowable period, and then, quite abruptly, they collapse. I believe this has profound implications not only for the United States, but also for all countries that have come to rely on it directly or indirectly for their own security. This country was born, as we've discussed, and grew up under the umbrella of the British Empire. Its post-war foreign policy has been, in essence, to be a committed ally of the United States under its imperial umbrella. But ladies and gentlemen, what if the sudden waning of American power that I fear brings to an abrupt end the era of US hegemony in the Asia-Pacific region? Like changes to the climate or the population, we tend to think of such a geopolitical shift as a protracted, gradual phenomenon, very far from our quotidian preoccupations. But history suggests it may not be so slow-acting. If I may return to the terminology of the artist Thomas Cole, painter of the course of empire, the shift from consummation to destruction and then to desolation is not cyclical. It can be very, very sudden. I wonder, are we ready for such a dramatic change in the global balance of power? Well, judging by what I have heard since I arrived here last Friday, the answer is no, not bloody likely. Australians, as far as I can see, outside at least the rarefied atmosphere of the CIS Consilium, are simply not thinking about that kind of stuff. A favourite phrase
in this country is now dramas. But ladies and gentlemen, dramas lie ahead, and soon, as the nasty fiscal arithmetic of imperial decline drives yet another great power over the edge of chaos. Thank you very much.
Yes, by any meaningful measure, the fiscal position of the United States today is worse than that of Greece. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, you're listening to Professor Neil Ferguson. He's delivering the Centre for Independent Studies' 26th annual John Bonython Lecture, Empires on the Edge of Chaos, and you're with me, Geraldine Doogue. And I was struck by his argument that in imperial crises, it's not the material underpinnings of power that really matter, it's expectations of future power in the eyes of those with the power and even more in the eyes of their enemies. Very much a question of perceptions. I thought he made that point extremely well. Now, there was some time for questions after the lecture, so let's return to the Four Seasons Hotel in Sydney and Professor Neil Ferguson.
Given Britain and the US actively use military power to underpin their empires, do you think China can sustain its empire without similar military spending and, more critically, warfighting experience? Or will China have to use soft power instead?
That's a lovely question. How far will China, if it's to be an imperial power, have to rely on military force to make that possible? Empires are funny things. They don't just arise because of the exercise of military power. Some do, some depend heavily on that. But some empires, if you look at the entire population of empires through history, some empires arise almost in a fit of absence of mind, as Seeley famously said of the British Empire, not because of a conscious decision to exercise military power, but because commercial imperatives give rise to forms of overseas expansion that nobody quite planned. And I think a really good illustration of this at the moment is the way that China is acquiring commodity-producing assets all over the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but not just there. About half of their foreign direct investment is going in Asia right now. That's actually the way many empires have arisen in the past. First, you get involved in trade and you start to buy the commodities. Then you find that buying them on the open market is really rather risky because the dratted price keeps changing. And then you say, well, wouldn't it be easier if we owned the assets that produce these commodities? So then you go and you build port facilities and roads or railroads, and then you start to buy the mines. And the next thing you know, you've got to do something to make sure that these mines or railroads aren't overrun by the locals, so you send a few more guys who are a little bit more heavily armed than the last guys, and next thing you know, you're in the empire business. That's kind of how it works. And you know, I have a warning for China. China's been an empire, of course, for centuries, a land empire. It gave up, as you well know, sir, gave up being an overseas empire after the death of the Yongle emperor. And it's re-entering this overseas empire game in our time. It's a dangerous game, and it's a game in which the law of unintended consequences plays a really very big role. Thanks for the question. Great question.
Just following on from your sort of comments about China, I mean, we see China as being the next emerging imperial power sitting here in Australia, and I was just wondering if you'd make more comments about that, because I see a lot of elements of risk there. It doesn't have a stable political system. Government is running an incredible fiscal imbalance. And I was just wondering if you'd pass some comments about that.
Well, thanks. It would take a whole evening to go through all the difficulties that China has to grapple with. Like any authoritarian regime that embarks on 10% per annum growth for a period of, 30 years, it's grappling with social and environmental costs that I'm sure Deng Xiaoping never wholly imagined. Having said that, I think China's less politically fragile than your question implies. If you look at surveys of Chinese opinion,
It's very striking that the Chinese government has more legitimacy in the eyes of its own people than almost any other government in the world, even allowing for the fact that it's not a free society. I think that tells you something. And those of you who visited China, and I bet you virtually everybody in this room has, will know just how powerful a cement nationalism has become in modern-day China. And that is something that is going to help them through difficult times. They, of course, came through difficult times with amazing success. Let's just reflect for a second on what happened. There was a 25% or so collapse in exports. China experienced the same shock that all the Asian export economies experienced when the U.S. and Europe went into recession. And most of us prior to that would have said, this will be a disaster for China. In fact, they completely rode it out, using stimulus in a far more effective way through their banking system than the U.S. did, and effectively dodged the bullet of the global financial crisis. So I must say I have a slightly more positive view of their stability. Not that I have a positive view of a system that is based on unfreedom, both economic and political unfreedom, but I think one shouldn't sit in the West hoping that they'll trip up. I hear too many people in the United States fantasizing about a China crash, a China crisis, it'll all fall apart. This is a totally classic case of what Sigmund Warburg used to call wishful non-thinking.
You've told us a lot about the chaos and the approach to the abyss. On a more positive note, would you have a 3, 4, 10-point plan if I was the embodiment of America or empire? What would be your 5 or 6-point plan to withdraw from the abyss before it's too late?
What a wonderfully American question. Actually, I won't give you 5 or 6 points, I'll give you 2. If President Obama were here and had asked that question, what should I do? I would say, first, you need to get Paul Volcker to go on primetime television within the next week and explain to the American people and the world how your administration is going to get the federal deficit down not to 5%, but to 0% over the next 10 years. You need a fiscal plan. And by the way, here are ways in which you could do it. Here are the ways in which you could solve the Medicare and Social Security problems through radical reform. Here are the reforms you could make of the tax code to simplify it in order to make it easier for Americans to pay their taxes. Here are the cuts you could actually make in corporation tax if you introduced a federal sales tax. So that would be point one. But get Paul Volcker to announce it. Don't do it yourself. Get somebody with the credibility of the man who helped slay the inflation dragon back in 79 to slay the deflation dragon that we currently face today. My second piece of advice to him would be, you need a grand strategy. Right now, your foreign policy consists of making speeches in which you say that you're nicer than your predecessor and everybody should like you more. You've given this speech in a whole bunch of different places. You tried it in Istanbul. You tried it in Cairo. You even did one to the Chinese in Tokyo. That's not a foreign policy. It's more like a Facebook entry. So how about a grand strategy? How about deciding what U.S. foreign policy is going to be in the 21st century as China becomes your principal rival, rather than, as it has been up until now, the principal source of vendor finance to the American consumer? Those would be my answers to the questions. I haven't been asked by the president, but I live in hope.
Noel, I'd like to ask you about a question in regards to the dismal sights and the perennial debate about government intervention versus a lack of government intervention. I'm going to use some Australian terminology. Your mates are Paul Krugman. And I saw your other mate, Joseph Stiglitz, on national TV last night, and they're talking about a second round of stimulus and perhaps a third or a fourth if required. Can you help us to understand what is it about the limits of Keynesianism and what is it that you understand that there is a limit to Keynesianism stimulus versus these other economists that seem to believe that there is no limits? Can you help us explain why there is this dichotomous controversy in regards to limited or unlimited stimulus?
The debate that I've been having with the man you term my mate since, I suppose, April of last year is a debate that's repeatedly been caricatured in the press as if to suggest that I'm paranoid about inflation and want a balanced budget tomorrow, which is not what I said then and has never been what I've said. My argument has been, as I try to make clear tonight, that if the United States has a fiscal policy that implies it will run a deficit every year from now until 2080, which is its current policy, that is not Keynesianism, that is a fiscal crisis. That is not a policy of which John Maynard Keynes would have approved. You know, Keynes once said, before he shuffled off this coil, that he was much less Keynesian than the American Keynesians. That's become ever more true as they've become ever more Keynesian. Paul Krugman is a clever man and has made major contributions on the economics of trade. But on questions of fiscal policy, he seems to me to be entirely out of touch with reality. And that isn't just my view. That is the view of Ken Rogoff, my Harvard colleague, who's a practitioner of the dismal science. Remember, I'm not an economist. I have the great advantage of not being an economist. I'm a historian. So I don't just look at the theory that you derive from the general theory of 1936. I look at what happened when countries did try Keynesianism year after year after year, because we've run this experiment before, folks. It's called Japan. And what you discover in Japan is that if you use deficit finance, if you aim to achieve recovery through fiscal stimulus, it doesn't necessarily work, but you do end up with a heck of a lot of debt, plus 200% of GDP in the Japanese case. Or, if you look back to the post-war period when we all became Keynesians, remember Richard Nixon, we're all Keynesians now, what happened? Governments ran deficits year in and year out. They sought to pump prime the economy, and we got stagflation. We got zero or low growth, and we got double-digit inflation. So, you know, from a historian's point of view, it's a little bit strange, suddenly in the midst of this crisis, to think Keynes can save us, and to forget all the advances that the dismal science made in the period after Keynes' death. All the advances seem to have vanished from Paul Krugman's mind. And I think that's what comes of writing a column in the New York Times. It's a very dangerous thing for a serious academic to do.
Professor, you've talked about the stability of the international order and mentioned some historical precedents, of which the Mississippi bubble perhaps rings the truest. And we look at the overall situation, because it isn't just America. It's a thing that's been spread like a bit of a cancer, you could say. And it may sound really weird to quote presumably an early John Maynard Keynes, who's supposed to have said, the surest way to overturn the social and economic fabric is to debauch the currency, because it harnesses all the forces of economics on the side of destruction. One cannot help feeling that where we have arrived at and where there may well be a precipice is the result of exactly that process, and that really some tests of any sort of social order, I don't know how you can easily comment on that. But
funnily enough, that quote from Keynes isn't really a quote from Keynes. Keynes made it up and attributed it to Lenin. And if you read The Ascent of Money, I explain where it really came from. It wasn't Lenin. It was another Bolshevik. And he said roughly that the best way of getting rid of the bourgeoisie was to destroy the Russian currency. And indeed, the Bolsheviks did just that. Many people today are worried about hyperinflation or inflation as the end game of all of this. We kind of fear, maybe even that's what the Chinese fear, that in the end we'll print our way out of these huge debts. And there's considerable historical evidence to support the proposition that highly indebted economies eventually do resort to inflation. That's true in the case of Argentina on more than one occasion. It was true, of course, in Germany after the First World War, and I could go on.
The trouble is, it's harder to generate inflation than it looks. And this is an important point to remember. Ben Bernanke has famously been quoted as saying that if it came to it, he would fly a helicopter over the United States, dropping dollar bills out the windows to stave off deflation. But if people's expectations become deflationary, then even doing that might not work, since they might just bank the money, put it in their savings accounts, not spend it. So one of the big risks we face today is not, in fact, inflation. We should be so lucky. The risk we face today is that the biggest economy in the world tips over into deflation. Of course, the values of bourgeois society don't depend exclusively on the stability of the currency. There, as usual, the Bolsheviks were oversimplifying things. And I want to leave you with this thought. What we call Western civilization, those of us who aren't too embarrassed to use the phrase, consists of more than just money, more than just the capitalist system, though that's clearly one of its foundations. It also consists of the scientific method, testing your hypothesis and trying to prove it wrong. It also consists of the rule of law, subordinating all other concerns, particularly the concerns of the powerful, to the rule of law, transparent law, law which upholds above all else the individual's freedom and private property rights. It consists of the medicine that keeps us all much healthier than I certainly would have been if I'd been born in the time of Lachlan Macquarie. I don't think I'd have survived 5 minutes of the life he led from the age of 15. And above all, it consists of a peculiar ethic, an ethic that combines a sense of the need to work for fulfillment with a kind of social obligation to those around us. And I hope that in this lecture I've tried to at least touch some of those points and to raise awareness of their continuing, enduring importance. You know, Australia is a kind of beacon in its way, and maybe it's more of a beacon than it's ever been now that Asia is on the rise. And if you are the great outpost of Western civilization in the East, you have a far bigger responsibility to the world than you ever had before. Let's hope you, if not your political leaders, are aware of that. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, what do you think? Are we in Australia the great outpost of Western civilization in the East? A nice challenge laid down by Professor Neil Ferguson. You've been listening to him deliver the 26th John Bonython Lecture for the Centre for Independent Studies at the Four Seasons Hotel in Sydney. And I was in China recently with Saturday Extra, and I particularly did notice the confidence in China. I mean, I suppose it's nationalism. It's certainly a sense that they believe, as somebody put to me, that the next day will be better than the day before. They believe China's coming back, and it is a pretty powerful sense when you're there. Now, if you'd like to hear this lecture again, if you'd like to download it or just leave a comment, please head to our website, which is abc.net.au/rn/bigideas. Thank you today to Timothy Nicastri and to Sue Clark. I'm Geraldine Doog. I do hope you enjoyed today's lecture. It would be hard not to, I think, whether or not you agreed with it all. And I do hope you can join me next Saturday morning from 7:30 right here on ABC Radio National. Bye for now.
Before the election, the Liberal and Labor parties bombarded us with ads. But it will be February 2012 before we know who financed their campaigns. That's right, only in February, the year after next, will political donations be revealed. Wouldn't it have been good to know who paid the piper before we cast our ballots? Paying for Democracy, in the National Interest, with me, Peter Mayers. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.